Okay, everyone, good evening. It's February 24th. This is our fourth class on the Nitziv, and I know more people. We've been averaging about 20, 25, so I'm sure more people will log in because there's no conflict. We will have a conflict with Purim, so that's 2 weeks from tonight, so we'll just skip that. I think that'll be the second, or the that should have been the second to last of the classes. But we'll get to that. We don't have to worry about that now. I just want to pick up where we left off last time with actually, before we do that, a couple of comments. I had a couple of emails. One, I was the problem with these classes is that I don't know, maybe 40% of, or even 50% of what I speak about is off the cuff. So sometimes it's not exact. And I thank you for those who correct me. David Safi, I think you pronounced the name Safier. He corrected me. I told the story about the Mechitzer, Rav Shlomo Polacek. I said that, you know, the famous story that he saw boys playing. And he said, why couldn't they have let us play like this? We would be the same Talmid Chachamim, but we would have had childhood. And the way I told the story is what I had always heard it was that he said it when he was in America, coming to Yeshiva College, which in those days would have been downtown. However, David correctly points, and I quoted, by the way, Jeffrey Gurak, because he cites the story again. And thank you, David. It's in Gurak's book, page 83, Judaism is a Counter with American Sports. And the story actually is not in America. It's told when he was still in Europe. And you'll find it in Bar Ilan's Mivolozhin Ad Yerushalayim. And the story is actually in when he was in Brisk. The rest of the story is correct, the way I told it. He says, why didn't they let us play? The exact words are, he was walking past the school in Brisk, and when he saw how they were running and having fun, he says, why didn't we have such fun? Would it have hurt our learning? If once in a while they gave us a chance for makfitsa, that means jumping, and ditsa, joy, having fun. So thank you for D to David for that. The other thing I wanted to mention was right at the end, I'm not sure if it was Baruch or Moshe from Lakewood, I think it was asked me about a question. About in Israel, religion, etc. And I mentioned, I got into the discussion that you know, this idea that we force them in Israel to have religious marriage. In fact, it's the only place in the world where Jews, not only do you have your forced religious marriage, but Jews are not able to be married by the rabbi of their choice. And I quoted Rabbi Bleich as saying that there's no halachic, not just obligation, there's nothing, no positive halachic reason to force people who don't care to get married halachically, and that creates enormous problems when they then, let's say, leave Israel and go to America or to go to Europe because they don't believe in the whole religious system. They get divorced without a get, and that creates the problem of mamzerus. And I mentioned Rabakshi Doron, therefore, would do weddings without kosher eating. I just happened to see on Shabbos, believe it or not, in a book I'm holding now, it's called Leibovitch Mitpalmes. It's Yeshaya. It's a transcript of Yeshaya Leibovitz's discussions with Moshe Halbertal, Zev Harvey, Avi Sagi, Yaakov Levinger, Tamar Ross, and a number of others. And he's page 106. Well, he was very opposed, of course, to all forms of religious coercion in Israel, and he tells a story on page 106 with a Rabbi Zaks. I'm not sure. This is in the 90s, early 90s, and I assume he was involved in the Mafdal or something. But he tells a whole story where Rabbi Zaks admits to him that he agrees with him that you shouldn't force people to get married, chuppah, kiddushin, etc., etc. But he says he can't say anything out loud about this because this will, call into question Mamat HaRabbanut, because it'll create problems with the rabbinate in Israel and their status. So I found that interesting. Okay, one more thing before we start. Because I mentioned briefly already, we'll come back to this a little more, the Perush of Anchumish of the Netziv, HaMek Shalah. I forgot to mention that in the introduction to the, no, sorry, HaMek Davar, in the introduction, he explains what is it that you're supposed to go into, what's this, what is he being Ma'amik? And he says, B'chol every time there's something different, this is in the tzeit. Every time there's something extra, every time you have something that you wouldn't expect because it appears, the words appear elsewhere. That's one of the things he wants to go into. And then he makes an important call, principle on the page before, principle number 10. He in the Netziv, in the Perush, he gives you all sorts of principles, how to understand psukim, etc. He says, nevertheless, Ein l'istor nitzav makom acher yotze min haklal. He says you're always going to have exceptions, and the principles he's going to set forward. And if we have time, maybe we'll see some of these principles at the end of our semester. They deal with grammatical things. Why is there dagesh here, not dagesh there? Most of the stuff are not of, I think, general interest. But he says, and this is obviously correct, you're always going to have exceptions. So what's the reason for the exception? There's some reason you can come. There must be a drash as to why there's an exception, and he gives some examples. And that's obviously an important principle. We'll come back to that. Okay, everyone, let's begin now where I left off. And the last thing I mentioned, so let's start with this, is Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik, he's known for his religious Zionist expositions. Became standard. I don't know if it still is, but it was standard for a long time in religious Zionist schools in Israel to read Rav Soloveitchik, in particular Kol Dodido Feik. There's a bit of an irony here because on the one hand, Rav Soloveitchik, you can say he's the least Zionist of all the Zionists. He puts forth this message, this great understanding of what Zionism, religious Zionism is, but he himself does not move to Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't even visit the state of Israel. He did visit Eretz Yisrael in the 30s, but he never even visited the state of Israel. And not only that, he was not so enamored by his students who decided to go to Israel. So it's a very strange position to be in as a leading Zionist thinker. In any event, his famous essay, though, Kol Dodido Feik, I think it's been translated now twice, is very important. And let me mention this briefly, what he's referring to here, because you'll see that it's relevant to the Netziv. In fact, I found two places. Last week I had one place. I looked a little more and I found a second place in the Netziv, which in a sense, perhaps you can say anticipates this, the whole idea of the knocking. By the way, the Kol Dodido Feik is not the only example of Rav Soloveitchik expressing his religious Zionist ideals. He gave other talks where he did as well in the Chamesh Drashot in particular. But Kol Dodido Feik is famous. I think what happened was that two people were translating it the same time. But what are these, the voice of my beloved, the knocking? So Rav Soloveitchik speaks about six knockings that show us, the significance of not just Zionism, but the creation of the state. And let me just mention briefly the six knocks that he speaks about. The first one is, and then this shows, the divine providence that all the nations of the world, East and West, so the Soviet bloc and the Western bloc, supported the establishment of the state of Israel. So that's one knocking. Right? What I mean by knocking, showing the significance, God entering history in this way to return Jews to Eretz Yisrael, that it's not just by chance It's something that's supposed to wake us up, the knock. The second knock was on the battlefield, he says. That knock, as again, the idea that something out of the ordinary, that the mighty Arab armies, you know, so many of them, were defeated by small Israel. I know that today, if you read historical works, they'll tell you that these Arab armies were not so mighty. But in any event, they still had many, many more people. That's the second knock. The third knock, and he thinks that this is perhaps possibly the most significant, is the theological aspects. Here he's really speaking about Catholicism, not Protestantism. And he says that the idea how the Christians viewed the Jews and you know, the exile of the Jews for all these 2,000 years were, this is from the Rav, publicly shown to be false, baseless contentions by the establishment of the State of Israel. The old Catholic idea that the Jews are a wandering people, just like Cain is forced to wander the earth and never find peace, so too the Jews, after killing Jesus, are forced to wander the earth. They're not to be killed, but they're to be placed in difficult circumstances, oppressed, and through their wandering from place to place, that shows, that's a sign of the punishment of them that will continue until the end of days when they accept Jesus. Theodor Herzl mentions how when he went to see the Pope to try to get the Pope behind this idea of return to the land of Israel, the Pope couldn't come on board. And even after the State of Israel was declared, it took a long time for the Vatican to recognize the State of Israel. And it's true that, at least publicly, the reason they said they didn't is because you have Christian populations in Arab countries and they didn't want to put them at risk. I'm sure that's true, but I think we also cannot discount the fact that of the long Catholic theology that they could not accept Jews returning to the land of Israel. And this was in the background. I can tell you, as one who works at a Catholic university and has had a lot of interactions with Catholics, although they've moved beyond the old anti-Semitism, the old Christ killers with Vatican II, it is still the case that for many of them, the idea, you know, Begin said it best, I think, that he'd rather have an Auschwitz, he'd rather have a State of Israel that everyone hates than an Auschwitz that everyone loves. You still find in the Catholic world many people who, the idea of Jews having power, of Jews controlling their own destiny, that theologically is hard for them. And I think that it's not just the Catholics, it's the left-wing Protestants as well, and that's behind a lot of the problems that we have. And so the Rav mentions that that's number three in the knockings. The fourth knocking is that there was so much assimilation. And after the Holocaust in particular, Jews, they wanted nothing to do with being Jewish. It only brought bad things. You know, well, there's nothing good about being Jewish. We're talking about obviously the irreligious American Jews in particular who are very assimilated. He mentions American Jews. The fact is, however, that the situation was much, much worse in Latin America and other places around the world. He says the State of Israel, a proud State of Israel, showed Jews that there's something to be proud about in being Jewish. And it, you know, stopped assimilation to a large extent. That's quite important. From everywhere we turn, he says, we hear the name Israel. It lets people, Jews, know that there is a State of Israel and that he cannot escape what it means to be Jewish. And they recognize that they have a fate here and with the Jewish people. The fifth knock is, he says, the non-Jews see that Jewish blood is not cheap. The very thing that the Charikarta opposes, the idea that the fifth knock, that Jews are going to defend themselves. And the sixth knock was that fact that Jews know that they always have a refuge. They can always go to the land of Israel. So these are the six important things that Rav Soloveitchik speaks about. Now, in the fourth knock, he really focuses on the fact that Jews can no longer hide being Jewish. But anyway, it's more than that. Actually, he says many who are alienated now bound to the Jewish state with ties of pride etc. So these are, it's both. It's the fact that the Jews who are assimilated now feel pride, and the Jews who want to assimilate, it's constantly in their face that there is, I mean, maybe the Rav was not entirely correct, because you have people like Bernie Sanders. I don't know if it does it for them. But for most Jews, either it gave them great pride, or and those who didn't want to feel this pride, it was always there for them. They couldn't just help but noticing that every day there's Israel's in the news, all the important things Israel's doing. So those are the six knocks. It's the Rav as a great darshan. He was the greatest darshan of his time. And it's the six knocks, kol dodi dofik. Well, now let me tell you something that I have never seen anyone mention. And everyone speaks about the Rav, and the knocking is it's playing on Shir HaShirim that speaks about the knocking of the lover. Well, if you look in the Nitziv, in the book we spoke about last time, Shivat Zion. I had one last week, but I went again to read over his other letters, and lo and behold, I don't know how I missed it. The very first paragraph. This is in volume two of Shivat Zion. The very, I don't have the page numbers because I have this new one, but it looks like it's about page three. It's the first letter of the Nitziv, the letter of the Nitziv explaining, not just explaining for himself why he's in Chovei Tzion, but writing to everyone, urging them to l'hishtatef b'prutoteihem b'yishuv Arzeinu HaKadosha, that everyone should contribute to building up the land of Israel, calling on everyone to be part of Chovei Tzion. In the very first paragraph of his first letter, he has two letters on this. He says that I've seen that we've seen that now Jews are returning to the land of Israel, which was desolate for so long. And then he says the second line that they're establishing Moshavot Unuchei Yisrael V'kol Hashem Dofeik Al Pitkei Levavenu Emor. He says that the voice of God is knocking on our heart to say that the time has come. Don't say anymore that Eretz Yisrael is forsaken. And then, about 15 pages later, letter number 14, the Nitziv writes as follows. He calls attention to Shir HaShirim Rabbah, Midrash Shir HaShirim, which comments on the pasuk in Shir HaShirim of Kol Dodi Dofeik, and he mentions how Chazal interprets what's the knocking, the knocking of Cyrus to return to the land of Israel. And then he says that many people in those days refused to go back to Eretz Yisrael. They remained in Bavel. And then he says that people today, they go on, they also don't want to return to the land of Israel. And he says, and today, what do we have? Kol Dodi Dofeik, the voice of Dodi. Who is the Dodi? Dodi is God. As he says, Dodi is Yitbarach Shemo. What does he say? Kol Dodi Dofeik, Bahamon Yisrael, Hoshiv Nishan. The Kol Dodi Dofeik is with all of the Jews to bring them back to the land of Israel. And then he says, and don't say that the Eretz Yisrael is going to cause problems if we go back there. He says, we don't know more than God, and we cannot, we can't push it off because maybe irreligious people are going, etc. But here you have the Nitziv saying that God himself, Kol Dodi Dofeik Bahamon Yisrael, that God is calling us. That's what the knocking is all about. So I wonder if the Nitziv, if the Rav was aware of this idea of the Nitziv expanding. Because already the Midrash Rabbah speaks about it, really, that that Kol Dodi Dofeik refers to going back to Eretz Yisrael. But I wonder if he knew that the Nitziv also picked up on this and elaborated on it, that now in our own day, we are again hearing, yes, they heard Kol Dodi Dofeik in days of Cyrus. We now are being called again Kol Dodi Dofeik, to return again to the land of Israel. And don't say it's wrong, it's not the time, you have to wait for Messiah or anything like that, because God is calling us. I wonder if this was a tradition in the Soloveitchik house. Remember, the Nitziv's granddaughter is married to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. So everyone knows that the Rav is a descendant of, is a grandson of Reb Chaim, but all the Soloveitchiks are also ainicles of the Netziv as well. The Reb Chaim was married to the daughter of Rafal Shapiro, who was the son-in-law of the Netziv. I'll get to the questions, Moshe from Lakewood. I'll get to what you say, a crazy in a synagogue. I'll get to this at the end. Okay, let's continue. This is also of significance and very similar to the Rav. For the Netziv, there's nothing messianic in this return to Eretz Yisrael or in living in Eretz Yisrael. We're in a strange situation, us in the modern Orthodox world. I won't say this to the Haredim because it's not really, and we have, I think, probably at least half, if not more, of the people who listen are from what we call the Haredi world. But right here on these podcasts, we don't really distinguish this. We're all one. One group in a there's a memoir of a he's a Soloveitchik. I forget his first name. He's involved in this thing called Beis Vod in Israel. They're doing like academic scholarship and Torah, study of Gaonim, etc. He wrote an autobiography, a memoir of really of how he comes from the very much the yeshiva world. And I'm not sure which Soloveitchik, if he's the Switzerland Soloveitchik or the Brisker Rav's family, but they're both very extreme, and how he is introduced to academic Jewish studies. And now you have a synthesis. You have a lot of these people in Israel who are combining academic studies and Torah, traditional Torah learning. If you go into the library in the not Hebrew University, in the National Library, you see this, and all the top Torah journals in Israel, you have these unbelievable people who know all the Geniza stuff, etc. But he mentions there that he was in Kollel. And the Kollel was, I think it was Rav Moshe Sofer's Kollel. That's the brother of Rav Yaakov Chaim Sofer. He's a big Talmud Chacham in Israel, as I recall. And one day, some people were talking about, it's a lot of politics, as you know, with the Haredi world in Israel. And the Rosh Kollel says to him or the others as well, that, you know what, we're at the level where these things don't concern us. We're just part of a Torah world where it doesn't matter your color, your kippah, this and that. We're all looking for the same thing, and you see it in the academic world as well. When you can go into the Jewish National Library and you have guys with payas and bibach yarmulkes sitting and studying texts and talking it over with guys with kippot sirgot. So both on the highest level in the Torah world and in the academic Orthodox world, these distinctions are not important. At least they're not important during the week. When they go home on Shabbos, maybe they are. But in the modern Orthodox world, it's if someone were to, not want to say the, that line in the prayer for the state of Israel, Reishis Smicha Kulotenu, which Soloveitchik had no interest in, you would sort of be regarded as not really a Zionist. And I remember once there was this, I was involved in something, and you had this Haredi rabbi. We, as students, we would go somewhere and we would daven with this guy. It was his shul, and he says he has no problem with the prayer for the state, but just don't mention that line. And of course, at the time, we thought, oh, he's not a Zionist, it's terrible, etc. But it doesn't mean he's not a Zionist. It doesn't mean he doesn't love the state of Israel. It doesn't mean any of that stuff. It just means that theologically, he doesn't believe in this whole notion, as Rav Soloveitchik said, that we can determine, that we're in the messianic process. Everyone says it in shul on Shabbos without thinking, but that has nothing to do with, it's a form of religious Zionism. But you can be a very good religious Zionist and not have anything to do with that. And the Netziv was one of them. He had no interest in messianic stuff. When the Mashiach comes, fine. He's a this worldly person. We're going to settle the land of Israel because God wants us to live there. That's the place where Jews live. If this is going to be the first steps to the messianic era, fine. If not, that's also fine, and we see this in a letter that he wrote to someone. It's in it's it, you find it in a number of places. The easiest place probably to find it is in this book, Igros HaNetziv Mivolozhin, but I know of at least three other places it appeared. And the first place it appeared is in was in the rabbinic journal Hamayan in the 70s, I believe. And it's a letter to I forget who it's to. I looked it up before because in this volume I have here, it doesn't say who it's to, but it's not important who it's to. It was, what's important is what he says. And he basically, I mean, the title, how it's given the title in this book is Shalom Lirot Yishuv Simanei. Don't see this return to the land of Israel in any messianic sense. And he begins the first paragraph explaining why he opposes the work of Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer. We've done classes on Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer is the originator of really of religious Zion, of return to the land of Israel. I guess you can call it religious Zionism in modern times. Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer, and then you have Alcoa, you have Eliyahu Guttmacher. But Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer is the most significant because he wrote a book, Drishat Zion. Well, he also was a great Talmud Chacham, halachic authority. He makes the case of offering a Karban Pesach. But the whole idea of the book is that the return to the land has messianic significance. And the Nitziv begins that he opposes all this. And one of the, it's interesting how he starts because Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer, the whole idea of nationalism is very important. Here you have, in the 19th century, you have the beginnings of nationalism. You have the creation of Germany as a country. Germany used to be different states. Italy, you know, nationalism was in the air. And that's when you start seeing a return to Jewish nationalism, just as the non-Jews are doing it. This is a sign from God that Jews also have to recognize that we too are a nation, and it's time to go back. And the Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer sees even the idea of the emancipation and the Enlightenment. These are all positive things because this allowed the Jews to be emancipated, and they can then find their own destiny. The Nitziv actually begins that first of all, he says that this false idea that he has that equals achuyot la'achenu, that that this is significant in a some eschatological sense that Jews are given freedoms that be equal. He sees this as einan ela devarim batelim. He doesn't see this as having any significance. And he mentions that this is what did emancipation do? Not whereas so Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer sees emancipation as a sign, it's a good thing. The Jews are being let out of the ghetto. Now they can achieve their own destiny. They too can be a nation to return to the land of Israel. You can only be a nation when you're allowed to have freedoms to express yourself, etc. The Nitziv says, emancipation, he says that on the contrary, you know what emancipation has done for Western Jews? With the exception of a limited number, it's led to assimilation. They've forgotten what it means to be a Jew. And that is the unfortunate truth. When people like the Chasam Sofer and others said that we don't want emancipation, we want to remain in the ghetto, they were not stupid people. They understood what would happen with emancipation. It's exactly what happened. You see it in America. You see, with freedom brought assimilation, and even without assimilation, it brought irreligiosity. Before you had emancipation, when everyone was in the ghetto, you had religious communities, and even people who are not so observant, they understood that come Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they have to repent. The freedoms that Jews were given caused the collapse of the Jewish community. So, of course, Rav Shimshon Bar Hirsch said, that's neither here nor there. In the end, you can't keep a community together based upon the ghetto walls. And if it's not going to come now, it's going to come, the emancipation is going to come, in 50 years. And after all, Hirsch said, we didn't put ourselves in the ghetto. The Goyim put us in the ghetto. So Hirsch was very opposed to this valorization, this glorifying of the ghetto. But and Hirsch's approach was that the reason so many people became irreligious when the ghetto walls fell was because the rabbis didn't do their job. The rabbis didn't recognize the fact that the times were changing and they have to teach a Torah in Derech Eretz. They have to teach just Jews how to combine Torah with civilization. That's what Jews always did. Instead, they were living like in Vilna in the 18th century, in the 17th century, instead of living in Germany in the 19th century. So it's not emancipation's fault, it's the rabbis' fault for not preparing the ground for this because Jews are supposed to be emancipated. Hirsch shares the views of Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer. But that's how. Then it Sid begins, and then he gets into the Eretz Yisrael section. He says, Yisod Das Hagon, he's referring to Ratzvi Hirsch Kalischer, he says, the basis of his view, Shezeo Tchilas HaGaula, the return to the land of Israel is the beginning of the redemption. And then he explains how we're going to get to the redemption. And but the Nitziv rejects all this. He says, "Ein adam yodea ad ma seder hagula atida." He says, "No one knows how the gula is going to come." He says that he says if you were living in the days of Egypt and you saw the exile, the not the exile, you saw the exodus from Egypt and all these miracles, you would have assumed logically, and it would have made sense that that's the ultimate redemption. Much more than today, that was a time of open miracles when God led us to the land of Israel, and that didn't become the ultimate redemption. So, why would you assume that today is? And he elaborates on this, and it's a strong rejection. He quotes the Rambam that in the end of the Hilchos Malachim, that no one knows how the end days are going to be. People offer speculation, but no one knows. And then he deals with the Karbanos thing. And then he says, he ends it by saying that Asur lanu l'haskir rayon shagula. He says, we can't speak at all. It's forbidden for us to talk about an ultimate geula when we deal with living in the land. Why? As quite apart from the fact he already said why, it's a foolish thing to speak about. But now he says it's forbidden. And he says it's forbidden for a different reason. Because the brief suffix Yishmohu Togar, the Turk, that's how they referred. Turkey was called Togarma. So just like we'd say the Turk, referring to Turkey as a whole, they're saying he's saying that the Ottomans will hear of the Togar, the Sultan and his ministers will hear about it. That Jews are saying that Yishev Haaretz is Atchalta Zegulahi. That's the actual words he used. And that'll cause them, they'll see this as some sort of act of rebellion. What are these Jews doing? They're thinking that they're gonna, because what does it mean? If it's the beginning of the redemption, the end of the redemption, it means that the Ottoman Empire is gonna lose control of the land of Israel. And that's going to lead them to completely destroy the Yishuv. And the other nations will hear about this and they'll, the Yigzeru Gezerat Haman, and they'll institute harsh decrees. We can't speak about this. The idea is just that God has put it in our hearts to restore the desolation of the land of Israel and make it a yeshuv, and that's it. And we believe that the geula will come. It's going to come however God wants it. Al kain eini maskim l'shuv l'tfis. But peace, sefer drishat zion. Therefore, he says, I do not give a permission. I do not give approval. Because the man was writing to him to get a haskamah, he says, "I do not want you to reprint Drishat Zion. Drishat Zion is a dangerous work because it can create problems with the settlements in the land of Israel from a political sense, and it's just wrong in that he thinks that he can look at this and say that we're this is the beginning of the messianic process." I have to say that the Nitziv would say the same thing about the modern religious Zionism post 67, and Rav Soloveitchik had the exact same view, but even pre-67, when the State of Israel was declared, the chief rabbinate wrote a prayer that said, Yisrael, and that's so the Rav is following in the Nitziv's path, strong in support of the settlement of the land of Israel, Zionist, no question about it, but not in a messianic sense. We've spoken about Rabbi Reines's position. We've spoken about Siresh Kalischer, Rav Herzog. We've seen all the various positions, and the Nitziv is very much an anticipator for Rav Soloveitchik's perspective. I want to mention one more point about his rejection of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. He says, I mean, it's not that, he didn't just, he wasn't looking at the land of Israel as a homeland, a place where Jews can go if they're being oppressed. That's important, but that's not it. He does see, as we spoke about the knocking, that this is the Jewish people's destiny. They're being brought back to the land of Israel. So that's quite significant. And over time, I mean, it became even stronger. He says he has another letter here where he talks about that very strong against those who rejected living to the land of Israel, saying that no, this is God's will. And as for the fact that people said, well, why are we more worthy? You know, other generations were much more pious. Well, when they were expelled from Spain, that should have been the time when the land of Israel is open for them. Why not now? And Nitziv says, he begins by saying, Hanistarot LaHashem Elokeinu. He says that just like we can't ask why God decided to destroy the Jewish, the tribes of Israel in the days of Hosea, why not in the days of Ahav? Ahav was much worse. We can't explain that. We just know what we see, and what we see is that God is calling us to return to the land of Israel. And this is different than Rabbi Reines' position. I mean, for Rabbi Reines, not always, but for the most part, it was the land was a homeland for an oppressed people. Occasionally, he speaks, God's calling us, but for the most part, it's not. And then Tziv, however, he speaks about how God is actually calling us to the return. But we can't say. We don't know how the Gula is going to be, so we can't speak in that sense. And we also, as I just mentioned earlier, we can't oppose it because it doesn't, like the Satmar maybe approach, or actually not Satmar, they're really theologically opposed, but more of a right-wing Agudas type approach, that would be, because it doesn't look the way we like it. The people going on Aliyah are not our type. No, we can't oppose that for that reason. God has given it to us, and we have to take it. Let us move on. I'll get to the questions already. Oh, it's already 9:37, another 10 minutes or so. The Nitziv also speaks and writes about how the return, how are Jews going to live when they move to the land of Israel? They're not going to be the chalukah system. That's the old approach. They're going to be farmers. And he sees this as also an amazing thing, Jews returning to farming. There's a great problem with Jews only being merchants. Jews, he says, were forced into that in the exile. When they return to Eretz Yisrael, they're going to return to farming. I have, so let me read you something he writes here in his commentary to Devarim, to Deuteronomy 32:12. He says that the problem we spoke, Sinas Chinam, that was the big problem in the Second Temple by Sheni. And that was, where did that Sinas Chinam come from? You know, everyone who talks about, Sinas Chinam called the Beis Hamikdash to be destroyed, but they never tell us, you know, when we're growing up and they're always talking about Sinas Chinam, they don't tell us where the Sinas Chinam came from. When we hear the stories about Kamsa, Bar Kamsa, but where did it come from? Then it still has an answer. Shahaya Avas Mamon Yoter Midah. He thinks it was economic reasons. People were interested in the materialistic, trying to get a lot of money, and that led them to fight with each other. And where did that come from? Vizeb Bab Mishum Shahayu Oskim BeYoser BeMischar. He says that they were too involved. Everyone is a merchant. Everyone is in business. They're all doing the same thing. They're fighting with each other. And then he says that this love of merchants, of a business, where did it come? It came from Doha Kaparnasa. They were forced into it. They couldn't make another living. However, what do we see in our day? Kodesh Baruch Hu Ra'asha Tov Yisrael V'itenu Hem Eretz Sha'esek Ba Merubah. God saw that it's good for Israel that they be involved in Ba. Here means the Chakla'ut, the agriculture. That's the natural thing for Jews. Of course you need merchants, but you need agriculture as well. The Nitziv is now reflecting what becomes the standard Zionist idea, religious Zionist and non-religious Zionist. The notion that Jews need to return to working the land, that's what's healthy. Instead, we were merchants. Oh, that's all we did. We were in business, and that's not, we're supposed to work the land, you know, especially in the land of Israel. It's one thing if you have a farm, let's say, and my grandparents had a farm in upstate New York, or Honkson, New York, in the Catskills. You had Jewish farmers. I know people, you had chicken farmers down by Lakewood, Adelphia, but you also had other types of farmers, real Jewish farmers. My grandmother told me that her parents, who were the farmers, there was a Yiddish paper. It was called Yiddish Farmer. It was a Yiddish newspaper that went to the Jewish farmers. So you had Jewish farmers. So that's very nice. You know, you can make it my great grandparents. They can make a living on the farm and support the family. It's nice. But that's just a secular pursuit like any other profession. But in Eretz Yisrael, when you have a farm, It's not secular. That's part of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. That's holy also. And Rav Kook, of course, would elaborate on this in great detail. So it's after we've seen everything we have about the Netziv, it's fitting that just like Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer has a kibbutz named after him, Tirat Tzvi, so too the Netziv has a kibbutz named after him, Ein HaNetziv. And I have to tell you also that the founder of the Mizrahi movement and a great friend of the Netziv, and a real Gaon Sheba Gaonim, unfortunately, Rav Shmuel Moliver, unfortunately, some today, well, not just today, but because of the anti-Zionist sentiments of some people, they make it seem like Rav Moliver is not one of the Gedolei Yisrael. Rav Chaim Soloveitcher, Rav Chaim Brisker had great respect for him. They like to downplay his significance, but if you know the history of the Lithuanian Torah world, you know that Rav Moliver was really one of the great Gedolim. I mean, Rav Rinus was a great Talmid Chacham, but Rav Rinus, no one's going to say that Rav Rinus was one of the Gedolim of his day, but Rav Moliver really was. Rav Moliver has a kibbutz named after him. It's named Gan Shmuel, but the surprising thing is it's not a religious kibbutz. It's how Rav Moliver. He's definitely deserving of a kibbutz, the founder of Mizrahi, but that it's not a religious kibbutz. What happened was that I heard about this years ago. I never investigated this till just a couple weeks ago. Where this, what the reason for this was, and the reason is that Rav Moliver's brother-in-law owned land, and in honor of Rav Moliver's 70th birthday. I can't remember now. Was it honor of Rav Moliver's? Yeah, not Rav Moliver's 70th birthday. The brother-in-law gave this land, and they set it up as an orchard and called it Gan Shmuel. But later, the land was given to a kibbutz. The kibbutz kept the name, but today it's a great irony that the founder, really, of modern religious Zionism, modern political religious political Zionism, because the Netziv is pre-political Zionism. That the founder of religious political Zionism, the kibbutz does not have his name. But maybe if you want to be messianic, you can say that it's only a matter of time. One day those Jews will become religious, and then the kibbutz will be religious, and it's fitting. And we know that all these kibbutzim, they become more religious over the years. But that's Gan Shmuel for Rav Moliver. Okay, I want to now return to another issue we were speaking about. We have so many issues to speak about. And that gets into how the Netziv defended himself and when he was involved with Chovei Tzion, because he's working with irreligious Jews. And he continuously makes the case that, it doesn't mean that I'm not pained by their irreligiosity. And of course, in Eretz Yisrael, it has to be religious settlements, but we can work with people who don't ex share our values, and that's okay in the name of the common good. That we can join together with them, and Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, buying land in Eretz Yisrael, why should we not join with the irreligious? We're going to see an important tshuva of the Netziv. We'll see how he expresses himself in that in a minute. But this then becomes the approach of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik has an important essay in which he explains his philosophy behind, because it was based on his haskama that Yeshiva University Musmachim were members of, let's say, the New York Board of Rabbis, the Synagogue Council of America, the OU is a part of, and the Rav explained that on religion, the Rav permitted New York Board of Rabbis, he wasn't really a fan of it, but Synagogue Council of America, he thought it was important. The Rav explains that the blood of in Auschwitz and the concentration camps of the Bundists, the religious were all mixed. And when we deal with the outside world, we go together as a group. Jews, religious, non-religious, we meet them together. And internally, of course, then we battle on these matters. And the Rav was very extreme when it came to issues of reform and conservative, going so far as to say that you can't even go into a shul without a machitza just to hear Tekiyas HaShofar on Rosh Hashanah. And so he had no tolerance for that at all. His great student, Frischel Schechter, is much more liberal than him on a lot of these matters. I think perhaps because we're not really in a battle with the conservative anymore. We've won that war. And therefore, Professor Schechter has no problem with students of his appearing together with a conservative rabbi, giving a Torah perspective and speaking in non-Orthodox shuls, limud, etc. But Rav Soloveitchik was very, very strong on this. And you see this as really as an outgrowth of the Netziv. Maybe it's just the family tradition. Different than the Aguda. The Aguda refuses to have anything to do with, for the masses. They will not allow, let's say, involvement with the irreligious groups. For the leadership, they do when they go to the White House and things like that. But the clearest example of this was when they had that rally in, I think it was 2002 or 2003, the big one in Washington, D.C., against all the killings that were taking place in Israel. And there was a lot of pressure from the Aguda lay people to go, and the Aguda still could not agree that they would do something together with the non-Orthodox, unless they are in charge of all the speakers, etc. Then I think they probably would have. So then Netziv has a different perspective. And I'll get into that in a minute, but before I do, I want to call your attention in this article I mentioned already, Gil Pearl's article, No Two Minds Are Alike, Tolerance and Pluralism in the Work of the Netziv. He quotes something interesting on page 79 from the Netziv that, and this shows you the Netziv, really an extreme statement of the Netziv about the irreligious, which puts into even greater significance how he was willing to work with them for overarching concerns such as Eretz Yisrael. I'm just reading the quote here. And this, I'm not sure, I didn't mark it exactly where it comes from. It's in his commentary. But he says that one who doesn't worship idols, but doesn't desire to accept the yoke of heaven, but rather to be free of any divine worship, is worse than an idolater. In other words, one who's Jewish, but has no, doesn't accept Torah, has no religion, nothing, a secular Jew, he says that he's worse than an idolater. Perhaps this is rhetoric and exaggeration. Hard to imagine, but he explains it. It's due to the fact that he has no yoke upon him, doesn't believe in divine justice. He rejects the Torah, saying it was given only to cause separation from idols, and he's not interested in that. It still is an extreme thing to say that I can't imagine anyone today saying that a secular Jew would be worse than an idolater in an era when a secular Jew meant Jews who were rejecting Torah. Maybe you could say that, but it's hard to say that today. The very issue that he raises, though, like let's say you're a secular, let's say you're an atheist Jew. Is atheism worse than idolatry? Or is idolatry worse than atheism? This is a debate. The Rambam thought that atheism is worse than idolatry. So if you're dealing with atheist Jews, if that's who he means, then it's if. Then the Netziv is following in good footsteps of the Rambam that an atheist is, even a Jewish atheist, is worse than a Jewish idolater. But it would be hard. Can you imagine today if you tell a secular Jew, an atheist Jew, that you're worse than an idolater? But that's what he says. The Rambam's passage thing is interesting when he says that an atheist is worse than an idolater. If you look in the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach, there's no commandment there to believe in God. You can be, according to the Gemara, pashtus, as we say, you can be one of the righteous of the nations of the world without believing in God. Just look at the list there. There's nothing there about belief in God. It's all about creating a good, functioning moral society. However, the Rambam, he sees it as basic, that belief in God stands at the essence of everything. So he, in the Mishnah Torah, he adds, and there's a lot of discussion of where he got this from. Presumably he had some source for this. Some have cited this Mishnah's Rabbi Eliezer, although it's not exact, but he says that to be a Chassid Umos Olam, you have to actually believe that all these laws that you're doing were given by God to Moses, which would pretty much wipe out all the Hasidei Umos HaOlam, because how many of them are actually doing it because they believe that? But that's the Rambam's position. Others have argued differently. Others thought that an idolater is worse than an atheist. So think about that. Now, the Gil Pearl continues in his article by discussing the apparent contradiction between these harsh statements, which I just read you, and other things in his commentary. And really, then he explains, and this is absolutely correct, that the Nitziv, there's two types of tolerance here. The Nitziv did not have tolerance for people outside the fold. What he had tolerance for, and this is going to be the whole theme, we spoke a little bit about it, we have to go into his famous Tshuva, in which he explains his position in greater length, the Meshiv Dvar, Volume 1, Number 44. What the Nitziv had was tolerance for other types of Orthodox Jews. He was, he had a big tent Orthodoxy. He did not have tolerance for people who were not what we today would call Orthodox. That term didn't exist in Eastern Europe, and Torah Jews. Today, if you tell people, he's tolerant, it means you're tolerant, and this is a characteristic generally of modern Orthodoxy as opposed to more right-wing Orthodoxy, that you're tolerant of the conservative, you're tolerant of the reform, you're even tolerant of the conservative reform rabbi because you know that, they mean well, they're just misguided, etc. No, the Nitziv did not have that sort of tolerance. The Nitziv had tolerance for Orthodox Jew, for Torah Jews, who had different approaches. And even for Torah Jews who did bad things, as we'll see, but he did not have tolerance for those who were distorting Judaism, namely the irreligious and the other so-called denominations. And Pearl concludes this as well. Let me just begin, just speak for 2 more minutes and get to the questions. Here it says my mic's breaking up. I'm sorry. I don't know if other people, let me know if you hear that as well. But tech support can try to look into that. But at the moment, we're almost near the end, so I'll just keep going. The Nitziv's famous exposition of religious tolerance, what is usually called religious tolerance, but it's, as I said, it's not religious tolerance the way we think of it today. When we say religious tolerance, even we're referring to non-Jewish religions. But his tolerance of, I guess you would say, of other types of Orthodox Jews is found in a famous responsa in the Meshiv Dvar. Meshiv Dvar is his responsa. Here is my volume. This is a good one to have because this edition that I have, you can see it on Otzer Chachma now, but it wouldn't be on HebrewBooks.org, published in 93, has a volume 5. Volume 4 of the Meshiv Dvar. The standard printings always, no, sorry, volume 5. The standard printings printed years ago with the old print were 4 volumes, but there's a 5th volume that was put out in 93, and it has some very interesting stuff in it, including, we'll talk about it later, but, and many people don't even know that this volume, this the 5th volume exists. Because if they had the old, if they grew up and they bought a Meshiv Dvar, let's say in the 70s or 80s, they wouldn't even realize that the new one has this. Well, in volume 1, Siman Mem Daled, number 44, he has a tshuva, and it's called, here you can see it. See it well, Al Yaminu Smol. Talking about right wingers and left wingers. And this goes on for 2, 3, 4, about 5 pages. It was subject to censorship. I'll show you what they censored out. This edition, I'm very happy I have this edition, but this edition, right in the middle of the tshuva, has a censorship. You'll see what they took out. Now, this tshuva has been translated. The whole tshuva has been translated into English. Fittingly, it appeared in the very first Eidah journal. And by Howard Joseph, he's a rabbi in Canada. There you see it as swords thrust through the body, the Nitziv's rejection of separatism. We'll see next week what is this expression as swords thrust through the body, what that refers to. The Eidah journal, you can get it online. I have downloaded as much as I can. Unfortunately, it's hard to download it now because the later, most of the issues, you can only do when you individual articles. You can't download the entire, each issue. I think there's maybe 7 issues or 8. And there's some good stuff in there. Eidan no longer exists, and I don't know how much longer the website will be around. Someone's obviously paying every 2 years to keep it up, but one day it might just disappear. So if you want to see it, go now. So that's the Eidan Journal 1-1, and we'll talk. That's where we'll pick up next week. Let me just make a mark here. We'll pick up next week on this with the famous tshuva. What caused him to write this tshuva? And then we'll move on. Oh, got a lot to do. We still got, I think we still have 3 more weeks maybe. So we're smack in the middle. Got a lot of good stuff coming. In the meantime, let me take a look at some of these comments. And Moshe from Lakewood says, the symbolism of ecclesia and synagoga. Well, what this means is that there's, you have on certain churches in Europe, sometimes on the inside, but oftentimes right on the outside. There you see this in Germany. There's a few places. You have these two images. One of the image of a woman. She's supposed to be the Jew. She's blindfolded, bent, and that's the like the broken synagogue. Sometimes she has a broken staff, and then you have the woman's, like the princess proudly standing. That's the church. And obviously, the whole notion that's the symbolism exactly, Moshe, that the Jews are condemned to be second rate, second class, always behind. The idea that we'd actually emerge on our own terms, and that they many of them cannot accept this. They're very happy with weak Jews in the corner who can be told what to do, and that's how Jews lived. Throughout all those years. So Moshe says that one of the few times he agrees with the Alter Rebbe is about emancipation. The Alter Rebbe, that was the great dispute among the Hasidic Rebbes. Do you support Russia, the Tsar, or do you support Napoleon and emancipation? And with emancipation, with Napoleon, the breaking down of the ghetto walls also led to religious problems. We will see next class, I think, something negative that the Netziv says about Rav Shneur Zalman, the Alter Rebbe. We'll get to that. Tzipora says that Rabbi Y.I. Leibus, Rabbi Y.I. Leibus, he was a rabbi in Queens. I have all of his books. In fact, I'm looking at his tshuvas, his Beit Avi here. Hold on a second. I have all of the volumes of the Beit Avi. I got them from the author himself. And so I'm very happy about this, that he sent them to me. So Tzipora says that he has a tshuva allowing the statement of Reishi. He says it's a prayer, not a proclamation. Rabbi Norman Lamb, I believe, used to say, Shetehei Reishit Smicha Kuvotein. That it should be. So you're saying that Rabbi Leibus says that even without saying that we hope it should be the Reishit, that that's a well, we often do things like that. Like how do you interpret in benching? We say that I've never seen a tzaddik v'zarma v'akesh lachem and his children go hungry. Well, there are plenty of times that happens. So well, what do you do with a case? Is that like a prayer or things like that? So we have examples. Moshe from Lakewood, it's interesting because according to the plain meaning and apparent ethos of the Torah, it would seem to encourage agrarian society and totally reject finance. So, for example, you have the issue of ribbis interest until Hillel came along. Yeah, how if you don't have capital, how can you, you can't have business? And it's through the principle. Well, clearly, when they're going into the land of Israel, that's going to be the dominant form of how they're going to live. Moshe from Lakewood says the whole concept of a commandment to believe in God is a paradox, as Rechlestai Kreskos points out. Yes, of course it's a paradox because, and this relates to how you judge the commandments and Ten Commandments, because how can you have a commandment to believe in God? Who is the commander? You need a commander before you have a commandment. The Bahag counts it, and everyone says, well, the Rambam counts it. And yet, and if you look in the Sefer HaMitzvos, it does say mitzvah ha-min, ha-manat, that's the word they use. However, if you look in the Arabic, in the Sefer Mitzvos, it uses this word itikad. You can look in my volume, Igros Malchei Rabbanon. There's two letters, one from Rav Kafach and one from Rav Shilat, on how to translate this word itakad. Itakad, Rabbi Kafach says it has to be translated as to know, and Rabbi Shilat says no, it can be translated as to believe, but belief, not belief like, well, I believe that the market's going to go up tomorrow, but belief based on strong evidence, et cetera, but not absolute belief like 2 plus 2 is 4. In any event, it doesn't mean belief like the way we think of belief. And if you look at the parallel passage in the Sefer, in the Mishnah Torah, what does the Rambam say? He doesn't say mitzvah l'hamin. He says mitzvah l'eda. There's a mitzvah to know. So however you understand itakad, and what does know mean? It means to understand the proofs for God's existence, et cetera. So the Rambam also doesn't count as a commandment just to believe, believe in God. I believe in God because it's beyond understanding. So therefore, I believe. Rav Chaim Brisker actually said that belief is precisely that which you don't know. That's where belief comes in. And maybe we have things in Judaism that fall into that. But for the Rambam, belief in God is not one of that. So he, contrary to popular belief, the Rambam should not be included as among those who count belief the way you usually think of it as a commandment. Ah, I didn't even see what you said. Yes, how can you have a command without a commander? Harold says he was a fervent Misnagid, not tolerant of the Hasidic view. We will see next week that the censorship that I'm talking about, which I didn't mention in my book on censorship because I didn't know it. I mentioned another example of censorship dealing with the Hasidim, but I didn't know this one. This also is an anti-Hasidic passage which is censored. But Moshe's correct. He didn't persecute them, and no one was persecuting them. And but when you say tolerant, he had disagreements. He has disagreements with the right wing in Galicia. This whole tshuva we're going to talk about is against them. But you might even conclude after we're done that the tolerance is only of the left. That's what he's more tolerant of. Well, we'll talk about it next week. Does Notre Dame Paris have it? I don't know if Notre Dame has it. There's one in Strasbourg, I believe. There's a big one in Bamberg in Germany. There's one in of the Klesi, Synagogue of Klesia. There's one in Worms, I believe. I get confused now with whether it's in Worms or Mainz because I go to both places on my tours. And but the when we were there last time, we couldn't see it because it was they were doing, they're fixing it up, so it was covered up by scaffolding. So we didn't even go bother to look at it. Moshe says it's still counted as a 630 according to the Rambam. Yes, but the question is, what's being counted? Is it belief that is belief in God, like a child believes in God, or a simple person says, yeah, I believe in God, or is it what does it mean belief? It means to have an understanding of who God is. Through understanding what the sciences are and how do we know about God? We study science, we study about nature, and that leads us to an appreciation that there has to be a deity that created it, et cetera. That's what we mean. Asher says, Orisi doesn't mean I never saw, it means I never tolerated. Okay, that's also a good way of reading it. I never tolerated. I guess just saying, okay. Okay, very good. What type of farm do my ancestors have? Oh, I've never seen the Yiddish farmer, Baruch. I'm sure New York Public Library had. They had a farm with basically animals. They grew some things. I don't even know the details. My grandmother was a child when they left and they went back into the city, but they had it. Moshe says there were still people persecuting Hasidim. I don't know what you mean by persecuting. What's the definition of persecuting Hasidim? They weren't throwing him out of communities like in the days of the Gra. They weren't, well, what does it mean to persecute? You can send me an email about that. Maybe we'll pick up. Oh, okay, I'll wait one more minute. What Moshe says about persecuting. Moshe, who's an expert on a number of things in Lithuanian Torah society, but and there weren't Hasidim really in Lithuania, just there weren't that many. Oh, acting in an unfair manner, defrocking. You had, I don't know, in the 19th century, you had Malshinim, Send me some sources if you know Malshinim, mean the end of the 19th century. What you definitely had is you had rabbis who were very angry at the Hasidim because you had Hasidim move into a town and all of a sudden there's a new power structure. The Rebbe comes and everyone's going to the Rebbe and the Rebbe is determining things for the people instead of asking the rabbi. And in that book I've mentioned a few times from the rabbi in Hungary, I forget the name, the memoir from the rabbi of Hungary, Olamo Shel Abba, he talks about how he had to go sit at the tish of the Rebbe, and he couldn't take it. He couldn't wait to leave the tish because he's sitting there with a bunch of what he considers Amoratzim and a Rebbe who's an Amoritz and listening to the Narishkeit. But as the Rav of the community and the Rebbe comes, he has to go sit there. So you definitely had a lot of that. But in terms of Malshin turning over to the government, what were the Hasidim doing? They weren't violating any laws. They weren't doing anything, and. So I don't know. In any event, we've reached the end of our time. I want to thank you all. We will meet one more time before Purim next week. And anyone has something to send me, please do so. Good night, everyone.